Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings and welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jajim, and along with me are...
Jorn.
And Juvon.
Yes, and we're back together again to talk about a book called Armageddon Sky, the Day of Honor book 2 of 4. However, I believe John will point out later on that there are actually 6 books in the series. This particular one was published in 1997 and written under a pen name, L.A. Graff, who include, at least, as far as we know, Julie Ekar and Karen Rose Cerrone.
Yeah, I have the Day of Honor saga complete in one volume, and it has 6 books in it instead of the 4.
And then I think you found one more, so who knows? It looks like they put out the 4 books and then decided that it must have been a popular and went ahead and had a couple more written.
Well, I know there was some confusion when we were trying to make our to read list, that I was getting confused with whether Her Klingon Soul and Day of Honor, that's literally the name of one of the books that is included in the series, were the same book or were they 2 different books? I know Day of Honor was based on an episode called Day of Honor, and Her Klingon Soul is part of the Day of Honor book series. So that didn't make it confusing at all.
Yeah, I think one of the books in your omnibus was actually a novelization of one of the episodes.
Yes, it does say that is.
But book 4, which is titled Day of Honor, is actually, it's set in the original series timeline, but is not an original series episode.
Well, wait a minute. Book 4 is not called Day of Honor on my list. It's called Treaty's Law.
Okay, maybe I'm confused then.
I have Ancient Blood, Armageddon Sky, Her Klingon Soul, Treaty's Law. That's the first 4. Then I have Day of Honor, the one based on the episode from Voyager, and then a Deep Space Nine book called Honor Bound.
Okay, and I think there was one more too, but I don't remember what it is, but it came out after the omnibus.
Well, this isn't confusing at all.
Well, at any rate, let's talk about Armageddon Sky. John, you want to take us through an introduction and a plot summary?
Okay, from the back of the book, we've got, all Klingons revere the Day of Honor, their most sacred holiday, but the true nature of honor can be a matter worth fighting over. Dispatched on a secret mission to investigate the raids, Commander Worf of Deep Space Nine and the crew of the Defiant find themselves trapped on an alien world, threatened by global catastrophe. Trapped along with Klingons who were exiled to this world for their loyalty to Worf's dishonored family. Worf must find a way to save the Klingons, whose honor bade them to keep their pledges to the House of Moog despite orders of the Empire, and to prevent a bloody massacre that will forever stain the honor of the Klingon Empire. Yes, Juvon, I have to agree with that sentiment. Did the editor of this book even read it?
Okay, the back of my book says something a little bit different, and it still really oversells Commander Worf. But it just says, dispatched on a secret mission, Commander Worf and the crew of the Starship Defiant find themselves trapped on an alien world threatened by a global cataclysm, along with a party of disgraced Klingons whose honor has driven them out of the Empire. I admit that still oversells Worf's involvement in the book, but at what point did they even say that they're part of the House of Moog?
First edition, back of the book.
Did they? I'm sorry. Did we read the same book? Did they rewrite in between our books? Is that what you guys got from the book, that they were part of the house?
It's not in the book. Who wrote the back description, even read this thing? Worf doesn't even go down to the planet.
No. I'll tell you what, this morning, getting ready to do this podcast today, I went on Memory Beta and I looked it up and I got a little scared. It's like, did I read the right book? You know, it was the summary of this book on the back, the blurb, has nothing to do with the story that I read.
I should say this before, because I set this off, Mike, but reading this book, I got really frustrated because it felt like the person who wrote it simultaneously knew a lot about Star Trek, yet knew nothing at all about Star Trek. So sometimes everything's going along, you go, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And then you run into something, it's like, wait, what was that? Have they ever even watched Star Trek before?
Well, John does point out a few things after, you know, did the writer read this description? The dishonor that the House of Vrag is exiled for is never really mentioned in the book, which is absolutely true. We know they're dishonored, but we don't know why. It is Sisko and not Worf who is responsible for solving the crisis. And what raids? They're sent out to find out what happened to the Victoria Adams, a Federation science vessel that was studying a cometary breakup that, of course, comet fragments and were falling on the planet, which made it become Armageddon.
And I think the absolutely crazy part about this book is that at the end you find out that the Day of Honor stuff is almost just inconsequential because they missed Day of Honor by a 3-day celebration, not one day, not a Day of Honor. Apparently it's 3 days of honor, but they missed the whole thing by 10 minutes. It just had to go over.
And frankly, I think that was kind of a cheat. They should have just gone ahead and stuck with it, but we'll get into that. We'll probably be getting into that and what happened at that part of the book later on. So,
did you guys find that some of the chapters it was hard to understand what was going on? Like the description of, especially I found fight scenes were a little bit hard to follow. Now that might have been because the two big ones had six people fighting it and like three different groups, and that made that a little bit hard to.
No, I don't remember having any problem following the fight scenes. I do think that this book to me captured the feeling of the DS9 TV series better than a few other books that we've considered in this.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying that it doesn't feel like it couldn't have been an episode. It's just like their understanding of the Klingon culture was simultaneously right on the nose and yet not understood at all.
No, I agree with you, John. The feeling of the book was Deep Space Nine, and I thought the characters were pretty true to the way I would see them being. However, you know, to agree with what Javon says, the first part of this book just absolutely bored me to tears. And if I had not been reading it for the podcast, I probably would have set it aside.
I felt a little bit the other way around. I found the second half was not that interesting. But if it wasn't for this podcast, I might not have even bothered finishing it. The first half I was on board with right up until, I don't even know at what point. It was kind of a little bit of everything where I just started getting frustrated with everything that was happening.
I guess I just felt like the exposition was way too long for this book.
You mean, are you saying that the story and the plot didn't move fast enough and maybe they were just trying to get a certain word count?
Well, perhaps that could be, but it just seemed like it just went on and on and on, and nothing really got accomplished for a long time. Now, the second part of the book, I don't know, maybe starting around chapter 10 is when things really started to pick up and I started to gain a little more interest in what was going on.
One thing that I noticed, though, going through the book is the similarity between the plot of this book and War Drums.
Yeah, there were some. There were some similarities, wasn't there? Except that they didn't haul out the marching percussion this time.
No, they didn't haul out the marching band. But what saved the day? Well, in War Drums, we go inside a ship that's buried in the planet to survive the tsunami. In this book, we go inside a massive cave structure to survive the cometary fragments that are coming into the atmosphere.
At least there was a little bit more, it wasn't like they found the ship and everybody went in there and everything was all right. There was a bit of a rigmarole to get there, and I kind of accept the caves a little bit more because they were established. The ship was very much a cop-out for everybody to live.
And who is George?
Oh, my God. As soon as they mentioned him, I was like, oh, that's Sulu. And then they just never tell you who it is.
You got the same impression that I got. But I think that was the red herring they threw in there by using the actor who played Sulu's first name, not Sulu's, the character's first name.
But they even said he was a pilot. They had a captain who was known for breaking the Prime Directive when lives were at risk. And you thought, like, at the end, there would be some sort of reveal. I use that in air quotations for people who can't see what I'm doing, because it's so obvious who he is, and then they just never tell you. Now, did they make that decision because it was so obvious, or at some point did L.A. Graf, or whatever their names are, wanted to write a follow-up that never happened?
I don't know, but it is very disappointing to the reader. If the reader has felt like they've solved the mystery, it needs to still be revealed to show the reader that they were either A, right, or B, wrong.
So now I have to question, if it was supposed to be Sulu, which obviously it was, how old would Sulu be at this point?
Younger than McCoy.
Yeah, wasn't McCoy 120 years at the beginning of the series?
I think 111.
So yeah, about 15 years, about 125, so maybe about 100.
Well, that would be if you were looking at Next Generation. Of course, now you got to add some years to go to Deep Space Nine.
But not all that many, and as it was kind of pointed out in Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, 2010, 3001 novels, you age slower in zero gravity.
Mm. Even artificial gravity?
Depends on what artificial gravity is set at.
That's right.
It's a matter of how hard your organs have to work. The possibility exists that it could be Sulu.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
But we are not given the satisfaction of being told we are right.
Unless there's some sort of book series that we're missing where they explain this, I don't see the point of it. And if there is, why isn't it mentioned at the end of the book, like, hey, if you want to know who George is, jump to this series.
No, or either that or it was just a wink and a nod.
That's probably the case there, Jim. It's just a wink and a nod.
And they like set it up that he is the reason why they have to be there, and he's completely inconsequential to, like, there's no reason why they have to make one person more important than the rest of the crew. I accept that the Starfleet's going to go in if there's Federation or Starfleet personnel in danger, regardless of how important they are. I accept that. Putting a red herring of this George character in there just overinflates the importance of it when we would accept them going in there regardless.
I agree. It was definitely a distraction, because when George was introduced, it seemed like this person was going to be way more important than they became throughout the book. And, you know, as Jorn said earlier, there was no resolution to that character at all.
I thought he was going to have some sort of insight into the Day of Honor, because Worf was on the ground, that maybe he was going to have some sort of insight into the Day of Honor that they would use, and we didn't even have that, because Dax apparently was their Klingon expert, and I accept that because of Curzon, but it still kind of brings up the point, what's the point of George?
And if we could integrate these novels a little bit better, Sulu has a lot of knowledge about Klingons in that he, in another book, is working with Curzon to solve various problems. And in even in this series, in book four, he's there dealing with Treaty's Law and the initiation, the events that caused the Klingon homeworld to set aside a day of honor.
See, and I wonder if that was maybe supposed to be original intent, but they didn't completely write George out of the story because they were being too lazy. Is that originally they're going to drop the idea that Sulu and Kor have a history that was going to resolve, that was going to help resolve this book, either in him having an insight to the Day of Honor or whatever. But for whatever reason, at the last second, they decided to drop it, kind of wrote his downplayed significance when they should have just wrote him out of the book altogether.
I agree. If you throw somebody into the book, or to put it a better way, if you introduce a gun in Act One, somebody's got to be shot before the play is over.
And that would have been interesting to an interesting book series if you get kind of the end result, only to go back a book and see why Kor and Sulu have this history. That would have been interesting and would have motivated me to, back in the day, if I was actually reading this, it would have motivated me to get the next book.
It would have helped tie the series together.
Well, shall we move on and discuss some of the characters? We had, of course, the DS9 people, all the usual suspects, plus Ensign Farabaugh and Admiral Nechayev, whom I always liked. I always liked Admiral Nechayev. A lot of people don't, but I do.
Is that Osgood person? Is that the same character that I see in like the relaunch era of books? I think that person's like a lieutenant on the Enterprise, right, in Star Trek.
That one went right over my head. Osgood?
Yeah, it's just one of the characters that were helping project the direction of the comments. And I was just wondering if I should have looked this up so I didn't have to ask you guys.
I suppose she says we don't know.
Yeah, I don't recall Osgood.
You know what? I'm going to quickly look it up while you guys are talking. I'll let you know.
All right. Good idea. Dahar Master Kor. I really like the way this character was written, and I wish that we had gotten more.
Well, we do. It's book four of the series.
Ah.
It got a little frustrating, though, that Kor's only intent was to keep everything away from this planet, without really knowing the why and wherefores that the Klingon High Council was isolating this group of Klingons. I suppose if we'd have known what it was they did to deserve this penalty, it might have explained more Kor's dedication to trapping them there.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, without the context of knowing why these Klingons had been dishonored and were condemned to live on this planet, it's almost impossible to figure out what Kor's role was, as you say.
Especially considering the fact that the Klingons, the majority of the Klingons that were there, including the lady, Rankin, who was in charge, felt they were honor-bound to not even try to get off the planet.
Yeah.
I was kind of all right with the way the Klingons divided themselves. It's just their interpretation of what their exile was, that the head of the house, they knew they were exiling them to a planet where the comets would kill them all. So she felt she was honor bound to take the death, where other people were like, well, he didn't specifically say that we had to die on this planet, just that we had to live on it. That's what he specifically said. So it's just their interpretation of how you perceive fulfilling your duty and honor. Also, Osgood is, it must have been a random thing, that it must have been randomly two characters that I couldn't find any connection between the two of them.
The point we were looking at here, though, was if we knew what they did to cause this penalty, we would have been more accepting of the penalty.
Oh, well, apparently we do. They were supporters of the House of Moog. At least that's what the back of the book says. I didn't know we get plot information off the back of the book now.
Plot information that's not included in the plot.
Plot that Worf doesn't even know about.
Yeah, and see, and that's the whole problem. One of the problems with this book is there's, Worf was not all that involved till later in the book, really.
Yeah, them choosing to write this when Worf is on Deep Space Nine is inconsequential to the plot of the book. Besides being the person who takes on Kor, and I do believe of all the people on Deep Space Nine, he's the one who could reasonably fight another Bat'leth Master's Worf, because we know he won first place in a tournament in the Klingon Empire. But other than that, there's no point in Worf really being in this book, so I'm not sure why he had to be on this book. If anything, it would have made more sense for him to go down to the planet and talk to them.
Well, they needed somebody to fight Kor.
And that's the only reason he's on the ship, but there should have been a better reason for it. Like, maybe Worf could have just said, I'm afraid because of my dishonor, they might not want to talk to me. Or they could have just said that there's bad blood between their houses and he doesn't care. He'll be like, hey, I'll carry out my duties on the ship. I won't go down there and talk to those guys.
So as Jorn has said before, all we needed was one or two sentences to clarify things.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I shouldn't have been looking at Googling stuff while he was talking.
Ah, no worries. So what about our Cardassian friends, Gull Hydret of the Olixin? Oh, I can't even say it.
Yes, I suppose if it's unpronounceable, it must be Cardassian.
Olzinder, I guess, maybe. This guy seemed like a particularly nasty Cardassian.
See, the whole Cardassian involvement is fine. Like, it, the only problem is that they say that these people are suffering from something. I forget when the males go into heat. So puberty, I guess, is what they're suffering from. But everybody knows that. So it becomes one of those things. It's like it's not even burying the lead or whatever. It's just you explain the plot point way too early. Like if the three people on the planet didn't know about, or because Julian was removed from them, nobody knew what it was. And then when they met Julian, they're like, oh yeah, they're here to get a cure for this. And Julian's just like, what are you talking about? That's just puberty. That would have been interesting, but everybody seems to know what it is. Even Kor knows what it is.
Yeah. Well, they needed this Drevloset, and they're calling Petarvo fever is puberty. I'll tell you what, just send them over 10 or 12 barrels of saltpeter, and that should solve the problem.
And another thing, too, is that Dax said, oh, thank God none of us on the planet who beamed down here were human, or otherwise they would have died from this. Well, all the survivors are human, so are Bashir. Now, except Bashir might survive this virus because of his heightened immune system. But what about all the other survivors? Why aren't they dropping dead? Maybe they should have just chose a different race for it to target, like any other race.
Yeah, that would have made a little more sense.
But I think they wanted this bioweapon to be used against humans. Now, could it be possible that I'm trying to remember more of the details. Could it be possible that the substance that they're having to get from that third batch of Klingons from the planet is the precursor to the bioweapon they're eventually going to develop to go against the humans?
I was under the impression it's good to go against the humans, but it's easy to modify to go against anybody else.
George, why are you still alive?
Exactly. Why are these... It comes from like a pouch within their intestine. So it's like, so there's been, and apparently it's like just readily available on this planet from the way they described it. I don't know. It might have been just a bad description, and maybe that's why it seems like, well, why didn't the humans just die then?
I think somebody needed better editors.
Yeah, apparently.
Well, I would have to agree with that statement wholeheartedly, because it just seemed like plot points were getting dropped and lost for a long time. You know, the focus was supposed to be to rescue the people on this ship that had gone down, and that got completely forgotten until almost the very end. And we get all this other stuff. We get these weird animals that people ride, and then the ape-like inhabitants of the planet who start out, they don't look like they're sentient, and then all of a sudden they are sentient. And, you know, Bashir, he just kind of drops out till the very end, and it just seemed like the continuity was off.
It felt like they should be important, and they weren't. Like, the race, the sentient race, irrelevant. They hid it in a cave anyways. It's not like they had some special technology. George being there, irrelevant. They would have saved Federation personnel anyways. Those big beasts, well, I guess you could argue that because they had the sacks that had the poison in it. Okay, I guess they could, you know, just more of a, you know, that's the driving part for the Cardassians, but the Cardassian thing was wrapped up so quickly, it itself became irrelevant.
Are you trying to say that one author wrote one part, another author wrote another part, and they forgot to get together?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That is, yeah, that it feels like one wrote the first half, one wrote the last half, and they forgot to put it all together.
Let me talk about what usually goes on in partnerships like this. Does it look like one wrote one chapter, another wrote the next chapter, first one wrote the third chapter, and you continue?
Yeah, it seemed like one person was writing all the ground stuff.
Usually author teams that work this way they write a chapter, they give that chapter to the other writer who edits that chapter, then writes the second chapter where he gives it to the first writer to edit before that writer writes the third chapter, and they get a chance to see where the story is going from each other's mind if they haven't made copious notes ahead of time about the book.
Yeah, I would think there would be a lot more collaboration involved there, but it seemed like these two were kind of writing blind. In other words, they said, okay, I'll take 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, you take 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and see what we come up with.
And let's get it to the editor.
Well, you know, and that could have a lot to do with it, a deadline to get the book out. Because some of it did seem to be rushed at the end.
In fact,
like this might actually be deadline driven.
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they actually wrote the two halves of the story, the two halves being everything in space and everything on the ground, separately, with just like they knew where it started, they knew where it was ending, and then they just went ahead and wrote. And then when they got everything together, it's like, okay, we have to do this to make it sense. We have to wrap it up this way for it to make sense.
Although the two Subox kind of seem to be similar, even though one was set on the ground and one was set in space, similar enough, at least according to Klingon lore, Klingon techniques, Klingon tradition, that they must have at least talked to each other before dedicating themselves to writing those particular segments.
Now, speaking of those two things, when Sisko had his Klingon armor replicated, he had a helmet and he had gauntlets with spikes. What's that about? Did I miss something?
No, you didn't. I think it just got introduced. If you think about battle armor, you tend to think about a helmet. You tend to think about gauntlets. And Klingon gloves have claws, so adding spikes to your gauntlet is kind of a descriptive nice thing to do.
And that's why I say it seems like the person or persons who wrote it seem to simultaneously know a lot and yet know nothing, because that description of it just didn't make sense. It's like the only time we've seen a helmet, minus the Kelvin universe, is what's the name of that episode where Alexander comes from the future? Anyways, they're on a Klingon colony, and they're doing like that, reproduction of Kitwine Kalis's famous battles. And when that guy came out, he kind of had a helmet on. And that's the only time I remember seeing a helmet.
I'd have to go back and rewatch that one. I don't even remember the helmet.
Oh yeah, I do. I do remember. He did come out and he did have a helmet on. But it, you know, it's hard to say what might have happened in the past.
Firstborn, season 7, episode 21.
And that's where we're very first introduced to the Bajaj. Is that not correct?
That is why I recently watched the episode. Is like, well, I should probably watch this before because it was kind of the only thing you really have to go off of what's going on in the series besides the Voyager one, which besides Torres talking about it a lot, there really isn't much information.
Maybe we should discuss that for a little bit. Day of Honor. What is that about?
I believe the Day of Honor was described in the TV series as a time when you are to reflect on what you've done over the past year and or your life, and has it been honorable? How do you need to improve to be more honorable? And are you meeting the expectations that you have for yourself?
Yeah, that sounds right. I think that's better than I could have described it.
Okay, so then how does the Suv Bach or the honor fight fit into that?
Plot convenience.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever heard the Suv Bach being anywhere else in the universe, but I wouldn't rule it out. So
it seemed awfully convenient that it's like a, because that's the first time I've ever heard of a 3-on-3 battle for Klingons. Like usually it's a 1-on-1 thing. So seemed like it was more excuse to get Odo and Sisko involved in a fight that was obviously meant for war.
Or if you remember that these two ladies live in LA, they probably, and what do you think is out there? But guys playing 3-on-3.
Oh, okay. I guess that makes sense.
So, but however, the honor fight, wasn't that the reenactment of Kalis and Molar?
Well, it wasn't a 3-on-3. It started off with one guy who was a challenger, then Worf pretended to be the challenger, then Alexander pretended to be the challenger, and then the guy playing Kalis came out and defeated.
Actually, it has another name. I don't have the term at this point, but it's part of a festival that, like I say, has a different name than Suv Bach.
But that is not a part of the Day of Honor celebration, because it would seem to be at least an annual holiday, whoever's year we're talking about. But as I recall from the episode, this was something that takes place on a very regular basis.
It's an annual festival. I just have to go back and do some more research to know exactly the name of it. But it's to honor Kalis's overthrow of Molar and freeing the Klingon people from his tyranny before he lays down the warrior law.
Okay.
I don't remember them actually giving it a name, but I could be wrong. I just remember it being referred to as a festival, but I might have just missed the name.
Well, we did talk about the three different encampment of Klingon exiles. We might touch on what they were and why they were so different and why they were living apart.
Oh, sorry, I just found it. Cult Bavala.
Well, like I said, we have the three different encampments of Klingons here. We have one encampment that is the main household that has been exiled to this planet. We have another encampment that's made up of the offspring that are broken away that don't necessarily want to just stand around and die. And then you have the third encampment that is made up of collaborators that are actually collaborating with the Cardassians to provide them with this drug for supplies that they can use to make their lives better.
You know, it'd been a nice just addition or subtraction. If he had that vial, that's why they were traitors and they managed to smuggle it to that planet. And that's why the Cardassians are coming. And then if it had nothing to do with these giant beasts and he just had it, and that's, you could infer that that was the reason they were made traitors, like we're inferring that George is Sulu, I think the book would have made a little bit more sense.
But then what would be the purpose of that first breakaway encampment that we run into?
They would be the actual traitors. They were actually going to betray the Empire.
They would seem to have accepted Armageddon as their home, is the way it seemed to me. And then, of course, they had their disagreements within their culture that they were building on this planet.
It does seem that it's their interpretation of the Chancellor's order to exile them is what they're really disagreeing about. One group has chose to accept it at face value and assume that because they're being put on this planet that they're meant to be killed. One group feels that they're exiled, that they shouldn't have been exiled in the first place, and they're doing whatever they can to get out of there. And the third group feels that just because they've been exiled to this planet doesn't mean that it's an automatic death sentence. If they wanted them dead, the Emperor would have just done it.
So there again, it brings about some confusion because we don't know why they have been kicked onto this planet and left there to remain in exile. There's no rhyme or reason to that.
And as we talked before, one line could have explained all that.
Oh yeah, one line would have done it. Just an offhanded line from Kor could have done a lot. They tried the overthrow of the Emperor. They're working with the Duroses. Whatever.
Even one line from Reckon, who is in charge of the house, could have done it too.
Yeah, any of the leaders of the three faction could have had an offhanded comment that would have explained everything.
Or they could have all had an offhanded comment that would have been different, that would have showed off their characters a little bit more. Kor would have emphasized that it's for the good of the Empire. Rankin could have emphasized that it's the honor-bound duty of the family. Gordak, this is unfair. I'm not going to put up with this.
Yeah, and then you could have got the real story from Katara. Katara?
Yeah, that was right.
Thank you.
But you see, you could use that to make to flesh out the characters a little bit more.
Which would have made sense, because that's how each of them approached the exiles in those fashions anyways, only to get to the last person who's being the most practical about the whole thing to actually kind of give you the whole story.
So now this leads to this question. Each one of these books is focusing on a particular character and how they're approaching the Day of Honor. They don't have to be Klingon characters to do this. In this book, in this story, who do you think is the one who's having to focus on their honor?
I don't know. I can't even narrow it down between Dax and Sisko, because they both seem to be equally caught up in it. But it was Kira and Worf who actually incited the fight.
Jim, what do you think?
I'm not sure.
My thought, reading through the text, it was Kira. Because I believe, as I was reading through it, she kept going back and looked at things in her past that kind of were looking at, were making her honor in her mind.
Well, that makes sense. But, you know, Kira is probably one of the characters on Deep Space Nine that absolutely shows the most growth over the series. You know, she starts out being very angry and very bitter about everything. And as time goes on, she learns that, you know, she's not the only person in the universe and she needs to get along.
And her sentiments about the planet kind of reflect that in the last chapter, where she reflects on how her beliefs in protecting other people Federation's ideals of always going in to protect people who can't protect themselves have now become her idea.
Which brings me to the point of the Day of Honor books are going to look at a particular character, and that character doesn't necessarily need to be a Klingon character. Honor transcends race.
And if that was their intention when they wrote this book, they should have focus more chapters on her. If anything, they should have almost negated a majority of the space stuff, and maybe a majority of the Bashir stuff, and the main focus should have been on her dealing with these three different factions of Klingons. I'd almost say it's as much her story as is Katarin, because Katarin is learning to interpret what honor means to her opposed to what the other two factions are saying.
Here's my speculation again. The overall editor of the series, who's not necessarily the editor of the books, came down and said, okay, we're going to focus this book on Kira and hers. You guys go ahead and write it. And maybe they didn't really know where to go with it.
In fact, I think Dax would have been a better choice if they weren't going to focus on Worf, which is the obvious choice. But I guess he might get a little redundant with it after a while. And with Kira's background with the Klingons, it would have been more interesting to see how she, maybe if she reflected on how Curzon would have interpreted honor and how she's chosen to interpret honor in her own life.
And besides, wasn't Worf the focus of the first book?
I don't know. I haven't read any of them besides this one.
I believe he was.
Which I guess we'll find out eventually, because I imagine we'll come back to this series at least 5 more times.
Yeah. So...
you don't sound impressed.
Well, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, I've seen who has written some of the other books, and I kind of look forward to them. But, you know, it was... as an introduction to this series, this, to me at least, was not an impressive introduction.
Well, the nice thing about this series, too, is that we can kind of pick and choose, because none of the books necessarily really link up except for having the same characters.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, let's move into our favorite points of plot. And we'll let you, Juvon, go ahead. You take that one.
Whatever plot ended this. I'm joking. Actually,
I think it was a funeral plot with a nice headstone to...
Yeah, that one.
Is there a version of Taps in Firk from Klingons?
Only if it's performed by Fred Astaire.
I actually did enjoy when Sisko was trying to goad Corrin to the fight, and it was ultimately Worf was the one who could who was able to goad him into it, and the fight they were having and how it went down was kind of cool.
One problem I don't know that ever got talked about or resolved is, can Romulan cloaking technology raise shields while cloaked?
Oh, right. We were talking about this in the chat. The best I could find out was that the shields and the deflector shields aren't necessarily the same thing. That the deflector dish kind of puts up like a barrier to prevent space debris from punching through the hull when they're going at warp speed. And if they can travel at warp while cloaked, then they obviously have a deflector shield.
But how much power are they burnt? One thing to deflect dust and small particles. It's another thing to be bouncing cometary fragments like billiard balls.
Yeah, I 100% agree, which is why I had brought it up in the chat earlier, because I was like reading and I go, wait, why do they have shields up? But when I looked into it, there's no real agreement if they actually are different things. But if they were, that would be the explanation.
Well, apparently they could take the shields and shape them in different ways to make these cometary fragments go in other directions. And, you know, the whole idea was kind of, to me, it seemed like an unscientific reach, because, okay, we got to explain how we're going to do this, and we don't understand the science, so we'll just make this up.
You know what would have been a good way to negate all that? Is there's just one asteroid, and they don't want confrontation with the Klingons, instead of having like a million.
Yeah. See, now, in my mind, I would say, okay, let's take the phasers, let's run them on a low setting and just melt the things.
And the issue with that is that they can't fire while cloak, and they were trying to hide from Kor the whole time.
Oh, well, that's true too.
And if you can use the phasers to melt the fragments, why bother? The atmosphere will do that for you.
Which is something they were talking about, is that they were trying to superheat the liquid at one point to act like a projectile to shoot off in a different direction, or some bizarre description like that. That was before the Klingons came back.
And then, is it my imagination, or were they having to deflect these fragments from all around the planet, or in just one location, or...
It was really hard to tell, because it seemed like sometimes they were coming from every direction, sometimes they were only coming from one direction.
Well, think about this for a second. You have a comet coming in. It breaks up. In what direction are the fragments going to be headed?
And it just seems like it's more of a coincidence that they're aiming exactly for where those people were settled.
Oh, I'm not done with this point yet.
Oh, okay.
Well, you would
think about it.
If you had a comet coming in, a large enough comet coming in that hits the atmosphere and breaks up, I would think the whole hemisphere would be involved.
Now, this comet broke up long before it was coming to the planet, meaning that the particles, the pieces of it, are going to probably have the same velocity and vector of travel that the comet itself had. So they're not going to, they're not going to hit the same place over and over and over again. They're going to move with the rotation of the planet, and they're going to hit precisely in one section as it moves around and around the planet, not on, say, both sides.
Yeah. Well, and then the fragments would tend to spread out a little bit also. But you are right. They would have to depend on the rotation of the planet
as to where they're going to land. And if they can, the fragments that are going to deviate the most are going to be the lighter ones, AKA the ones you're going to have to less worry about.
Well, yeah, they're going to be more likely to burn up. But they all seem to be aiming for the same place, didn't they?
Yeah, the science needed to be thought about just a bit more.
Yeah.
Like the Cardassians' ultimate plan was to push all the comets at the planet so that they could kill everybody and just beam down and take what they want. Okay, that's just stupid, because if it's enough to kill those people, wouldn't it be enough to destroy whatever you're looking for? Like, wouldn't you want to push the comets away and then go down and get what you want and then push them back, or just beat the comets to the planet and push the comets in to hide what you did?
Yeah, one would seem.
But we are talking about Cardassians here.
I don't think the Cardassians are that stupid.
conveniently, in this book, they are.
Apparently.
I don't know. My favorite point of the entire book was anytime there was a fight, especially the fight between Kor and Worf. Now, I do have a question about this, and I must have missed something. Maybe I fell asleep or something while I was reading it. But doesn't the story say that Worf had a batleth through his throat and he did not die?
I thought it was to his throat.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
Sounds like Worf got messed up. And that was kind of another thing that I was wondering, is that, like, Kor isn't really described in Deep Space Nine as really competent anymore. And so, yeah, I just question whether or not he could actually take Worf in a battle like this.
Except that he was competent in the episode where they had the three of them and Dax going after the albino.
And that's why I was thinking, is that, you know, as incompetent as he seemed to be compared to the other two, he still did survive that fight, and they took on like what, one for every one of them, there's 25 guys for them to take on or something like that.
Yeah.
Then later on, when they're having to fight the Jem'Hadar, he takes a bird of prey and is able to delay the Jem'Hadar so that the rest of the Klingon fleet can escape, even though he's supposedly drunkenly addled.
Yeah, he was having a lot of trouble with memory and things like that, but, you know, he also had to deal with Martok looking down on him because of the struggles that Martok had to get where he was, and Martok felt like he was constantly being held back by people like Kor.
Wasn't it Kor in particular one of the guys who held him back, and that's why he had a particular grudge against them?
Yes.
Also, too, they make it sound like him and Worf had never met before, so then I was wondering at what point does this happen, because it also seems like the episode where they go find the Sword of Kalis, it seemed like they never met before either.
If I'm not mistaken, the Sword of Kalis episode is in season 4, and that is the season that Worf came on to Deep Space Nine.
So this book must have been written while that episode was in production for them to know that Worf was going to be on the series. But the picture, they have Worf Oh, no, they have Worf in the red uniform. Okay, I thought it was the other one. Okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
But I think your point was, how many times can Worf meet Kor for the first time?
Yeah, that's fair. That was kind of my question. And the fact that he meets him the first time, I guess this book is just out of continuity, so I guess I can't get too upset.
Well, it goes right back to what we talked about at the very beginning of, it looks like you've got one writer who's very knowledgeable about Trek and one writer who's not.
Yeah. Yeah, it did really feel like that reading the book. Unfortunately, because whoever really knows Trek, if they wrote by themselves, they probably, the book probably would have been very rememberable, opposed to being a little upsetting.
Plagued with problems that an editor could solve.
Any themes we want to discuss?
I liked the theme of them interpreting the Chancellor's exile orders, that how they chose, we're going to do whatever we want, but the two main factions, well, even that one group, once they realized that what they're doing could spell the death of the Klingon Empire, they all chose to do the honor deaths instead of allowing the plan to come to fruition. So I guess it was very interesting to see those factions of Klingon interpret honor in their own way.
Yeah, I think honor is very important to this whole series. It's supposed to be a chance to look at all the angles of honor from as many perspectives as they can come up with, which is possibly how they came up with a fifth and maybe sixth book in this series that is not part of the original four.
And it's unfortunate that the book turned out the way it did, because you have those three factions, then you have Kor, then you just have the Federation characters. It'd been a very interesting, it'd been interesting to see a deconstruction of what honor is and what it means to different people and how you interpret something. So based off of this almost religious rhetoric that the Klingons have of honor. So the book had a lot of potential when you look at it that way.
You had the ability to look at Kira's that we talked about. You had the ability to look at Dax, who had all the different lifetimes that she could have dealt into. You had all kinds of potential for mirroring honor and how it can go about shaping the world in which you live, the world in which you make.
What do you think, Jim?
I don't know. The themes, to me, it seemed to be really jumbled. As far as the theme of honor was concerned, wow. I wasn't sure myself whose honor we were following. I can sure see the points that you guys have made with Kira's honor and Dax's honor, Worf's honor, which really didn't seem to play into it, Sisko's honor, and then the honor of the Cardassian, who seemed to have no honor. So if honor was the main theme of the book, it was somewhat a little bit lost on me.
I think the point we're making is that, and we're forgetting here Odo's part of it too. I think the point we're making here is you had the potential to look at all these different mirrors of honor, and you didn't get the chance to explore any of them.
I'd say out of all the lower tier books we did read, this does, I feel like this one had the most potential.
That could be. Well, you know, every book has potential, but you have to have competent writers and competent editors to make it work.
I haven't felt about that with all the books we've read, though.
Well, how about closing thoughts, gentlemen, or have we pretty well covered all that?
I don't believe I have anything else.
The only thing I can think of is, who is George anyway?
I'm not George. Are you George?
Not since the last time I checked.
I guess George is just going to be a mystery. All right. Do we know what we're reading next?
I think with this book, it was a case of, the idea of having like these, I guess, five different factions working against each other, the three on the planet, the ship with Kor and Starfleet in general, and them interpreting what it means to be honorable and seeing the five factions interpret what it means to be honorable was a very interesting idea. It's just the execution just didn't come through. And I think that's the biggest, if they take, I don't know if it's just, maybe there's other books out there that by L.A. Graf that are awesome, or if they're just kind of known for just turning out mediocre stuff, but I'd be surprised if that's authored by them, just to see if this is how they usually write, because I really like the ideas. And I think if I would like to think if they had a little bit more time, they could have pulled it off. I feel like this is just a time crunch issue.
Okay. So how would you gentlemen rate this book on a scale of 1 to 5?
I suppose I'd have to go with a 2. It had potential, but like Juvon just said, it wasn't well executed.
Probably a 2 as well. Maybe even a 2.5. They got the characterization is one thing that I always look at. Like if the characters aren't acting like they should be, I find that very upsetting. But the DS9 characters and even Kor, a character who's been established, I feel like they're acting like the way they should be. And I feel like that's half the battle with reading these books.
Okay, and I'm going to go with 2 myself. So we have an overall rating of 2. I guess on Google it's rated at 3 stars out of 5. So I guess we're not too far off base.
We're just more hypercritical.
How many people actually evaluated it, though?
Well, that's a very good question.
Goodreads, they got a 3.52 of 180 ratings.
Wow, that's pretty generous.
And a vast majority of them gave it a 3, and after that, it's 4s, 5s, 2s, then 1. So it looks like more people felt all right about it and good about it than disliked.
But remember, guys, we're reviewing this thing from a Klingon perspective. So we're looking at things a little bit differently than these other readers have looked at.
Oh, yeah. Adrian gave it a 4 out of 5. And he wrote a huge essay, so I'm not really going to get into what he wrote.
Yeah, Jorn, that's a very good point, too. So I understand next we are going to read the 3rd book in the Rionsu series, Sword Hunt. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's kind of a misnomer, though, to say 3rd book, because after the 3rd and 4th books came out, they were later edited into 1 book. We're going to be reading the 1st book of those 2, which is Sword Hunt, before we review the 2nd part of that book.
And of course, that all depends on our guests being able to join us, and hopefully that's going to happen.
Yes, I understand this weekend at Starbase Indy, they've been doing Andorians over the weekend.
Oh-ho.
They're with the Imperial Zeon Xeno Legion. So the Imperial Xeno Legion of Keg handles all those characters other than humans and other than Klingons from the Star Trek universe that people want to try and be in Keg and portray.
Yes. So, Juwan, you want to tell everybody how they can get in touch with us and all that good closing stuff that we do?
Sure. You can find us on Facebook if you look up Keg Podcasts. You can email us at podcast@keg.org. Even if you just go to keg.org/podcasts, you can find all of our podcasts, but we also pop up on Google and iTunes. And if you guys are on Facebook, keep an eye out for our posts about voting on the must-read list. We're just looking for yes and no's on books that we've previously reviewed on this, so we can make like a master recommendation list.
All right, fair enough. So, for Bound by Honor, I am Jajim.
I am Jorn.
Juvon. Kapla.
Kapla.
Kapla. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kurg Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Ka-plop!